Please do ask questions, but of course, don't be too disruptive. You know? Otherwise, I won't be able to say everything I have to say. But I was, when I was invited to this, I was very pleased because it sort of gives me an opportunity to put some ideas into place. Of course, I come from a physics background, so a little different. And as you'll probably see, I am going to be very pragmatic in my approach to these issues. Now, but before I do that, just inspired by John's talk, I have, which is not planned here, I just have one comment to make, which may or may not be useful, which is the notion of initial conditions that we think about. Sorry to Lee and Lisa, I know you should say that, so I'm going to say that before I start my talk, which is essentially, there. In my mind, there are two kinds of initial conditions, you know, when you think about physical systems. There are initial conditions that you may want to call the subsystems, which you can control in the laboratory. They have absolute control over, and you can test hypotheses, and you can repeat experiments, and you can then come up with some viable models and describe things that you observe. But then you have a different set of initial conditions, which are what I would call perhaps historical conditions, where you do not have the ability to make experiments and compare things. Example, the universe, the origin of life on Earth. You'll never be able to know exactly how life originated here on Earth. You may even be able to make life in the laboratory, but that may be just a pathway to life. You just do not know how it could happen here. And even the origin of mind, considering that we only have one example of mind, which is ourselves. So these sort of examples of oneness are very different than the ones in which we can actually set up conditions and make this discussion of initial conditions somewhat more, perhaps more complicated in my mind. So I just wanted to throw that in for maybe us to discuss a little later. So I want to talk about something which, of course, I do not know the answer, which is how much can we know of the world? But I would like to suggest a few things that may be useful in thinking about this. And I would like to do it in three different ways. I want to talk about tools and how tools shape worldviews. And I also want to talk about the problem of the first cause, and finally about what we call knowledge and what we call ultimate reality. Okay, so let's try that. Okay, so first thing of all is that this is a very old battle between empiricism and rationalism. Right, and perhaps we can think of it in terms of even the pre-Socratics, right? Even the beginning of philosophy, you can think that there were kind of two ways of thinking about the world. You could talk about the world of becoming, like Thales and Heraclitus, in which there was transformation, there was change in the world, and there was this world of being, like Parmenides, that wanted to find the thing that does not change, sort of this oneness, the stuff that is independent of time. And perhaps these sort of tendencies are still part of the way we think about the world. If you think about the laws of nature as being unchangeable things, like we assume that they always have been and will be, and that's an assumption, because we do not know exactly, you know, if you go way back into the past, if that's true or not, but we assume it's true, then you think of them as things that do not change as well. And so when we construct our view of the world, we sort of use these elements that have been around for a very long time. And of course, the perennial discussion between the empiricists and the rationalists was, can we think of the world only from the outside in? That is, do we always gather information from the outside in? And the rationalists would say, no, you need to have an a priori discussion or construction of the world that we can use our minds to understand how the world is to be. And then perhaps Kant would say, well, it's neither one nor the other, you know, because the way we think about things is already the way the world is, in a sense. So you cannot really separate the mind from what the world is about. Now, what I wanted to mention then is that the way we see the world is very much dependent on the tools we have to see the world. And because of that, the way we have understood what the world is about has changed in time completely, right? So I have here sort of these very basic examples of that. So if you think of astronomy before and after Galileo, well, it was a very different astronomy because after Galileo, he could see things that no one else could have seen before. And so his image of the world, and hence our conception of what the world is about, changed because we had a new tool that allowed us to see things that we could not see before, right? And so what we call the world, right, the world that we see, is very much dependent on these tools that we have to see the world. And there are lots of things that without the tools, not seeing them, not seeing what's out there, we cannot anticipate what the world is about. And so, and that in fact is what happens, right? If you go on and you follow this simple history, you think of Hubble with the 100-inch Mount Wilson telescope in the 20s and how he changed the world completely, right, in 1924, showing that, hey, the Milky Way is not the only galaxy that exists in the universe. There are many, many other galaxies out there. And then in 1929, showing that the universe is actually expanding, that there is a redshift of the distant galaxies. So the tools here are bringing to us things that we could not have anticipated about the world. And of course, if you move on, right, fast forward to now, you have the Hubble Space Telescope, and hopefully in 2014, the James Webb Space Telescope, which is going to be a big infrared thing, that will allow us to see things that we have not seen before, and probably discover things that we cannot anticipate. So you can see that by telling the story this way, I'm already siding with the view that I do not believe it's possible to have an a priori construction of the world. You know, I think that a lot of what we construct of reality is based on what we can see of reality. And so the other point that I want to make, you know, and what I want to do here is the reason why I put this, the title of this talk as a question mark is that I want to invite, it's an invitation, right? So I want to throw things at people and then hopefully this will inspire us to some discussions later on. The other thing is that the tools that we use to measure reality, they themselves have limits, okay? And that's really very important because it tells you that you cannot see beyond what those tools allow you to see, okay? And because tools will always have limits, there's always going to be a portion of reality that is not going to be accessible to us, right? So, and you can construct the best possible detectors, etc., but still, you know, there is going to be a limit beyond which we cannot see. And so our knowledge of the world is very much restricted by our ability to construct tools that allow us to measure what the world is about. So let me give you an example. We say tremendous confidence, energy is conserved, right? So that's like the sacred law of physics, energy is conserved. We can talk about invariances to discuss why it's conserved. But then you think, well, but really, how well is it conserved? You know, how do we know it's conserved? Well, it's conserved within the limits of the accuracy of our measuring tools. So there's a consensual thing that we say by looking at nature and by measuring things for a very, very long time, where we go and say, yes, you know, it's true, energy is conserved. But you look at, for example, the history of 20th century cosmology, and you see in 1948 the steady state model, right, which was sort of the competition with the Big Bang. They didn't like the idea that time was different from space in the sense that, you know, in the general cosmological principle, space is homogeneous, but time had a beginning, if you want. And so they come up with the perfect cosmological principle and say, no, time is also homogeneous, meaning it has no beginning, it has no end. But the price they had to pay for that was to say, well, but we have to create matter at a certain amount in order to be, make the, you know, the energy density constant, you know, on average. So they will violate energy conservation, right? And of course, that was a no-no, right? How can you possibly violate energy conservation? But the point is, the amount of, if you put the numbers in, the amount of energy violation is so small that it's immeasurable. So they tell you, how do you know that energy is not conserved if you cannot measure this amount of violation that we are proposing here? So that poses a question, you know, as to how trustworthy, to use that, our laws of nature are if they really depend on the precision of our measuring tools, right? So,
can I just make a comment?
Please.
There are two sorts of limits. One is the practical limits, which we're discussing there, and then there could be fundamental limits in principle.
Yes.
We live in a universe of finite resources.
Yes. Oh, that's true, too. Yes. And then you can even talk about, is there an intrinsic limit to measurement from a quantum mechanical perspective?
Right. But that would be included in finite sources.
Yes.
And there's also potential limits on what we conceive of, or at least what we conceive of right now, our cognitive models.
Exactly. And I'll, at the end, I'll mention some of that, and that's a very good point. So the point here that I want to say is that there is a lot of the world that we cannot measure at any given moment in time. There is a lot of the world that we cannot measure, right? And that we do not see. So the question is, what is real and what's not? So let me give you a couple of examples, right? So think of a particle that decays so fast that it cannot be detected by our present technology, okay? It's there, but we cannot see it, right? So maybe sometime in the future, detector technology is going to be advanced and we'll see it. And that will become part of reality. And that particular particle could violate all sorts of things that we now believe are real, right? So, or we believe are correct. Another example, which is actually a precise example, which is if you go to the LHC and you look at the trigger technologies that they have on the detectors there, they are not able to measure a particle called an axion, which has a mass of about 10 to minus 3 electron volts, so extremely light particle, okay? They could not measure that particle with current technology, which does not mean that the axion doesn't exist. It just means that it cannot be measured by, you know, the detector technology that we have here, right? So this sort of incremental knowledge of the world, to me, is absolutely essential when we're thinking about what reality is and what the laws of nature are. And then there's this other problem that I wanted to bring in, which is the fact that even what we can see, like the detectors can detect things, we won't measure them because we may filter that data out, right? So again, the LHC is an excellent example of that. I don't know what the numbers are, I always get them confused, but something like in a year you could pile up data with DVDs that go from here to the moon or something like that, and clearly you cannot analyze all of that, so you have to filter your data, right? How do you filter your data? Well, you use criteria. What criteria are those? They are based on speculations, I mean, theories that we don't know if they are right or wrong. Example, if you believe there is supersymmetry, then you go and you say, well, you know, if there are some decays which are typical supersymmetric decays, and hence I'm going to use my triggers, that is, I'm going to select the data that will see those decays, right? And what if it's not supersymmetry? What if something completely different that you cannot predict with your current theories? You may or may not detect that. You know, it may be missing energy of some kind, it may be something else, but there is a danger, which I think the particle experimentalists are aware of, that you may lose some of the things simply because you do not know they're there and you're not selecting the data to see it, okay? So it becomes very complicated, you know, to describe what reality becomes if we are anticipating, perhaps wrongly, what it can be, right? And that's sort of an issue.
Of this, one that I emphasize to my two young girls, and it's very commonplace, is just the idea that if you take a big stone and a little stone and you drop them at the same time, they hit the ground at the same time. Surely people saw this for thousands of years before Galileo, with their eyes, in the sense of having the tool to see it, but being prepared to notice that this was an important data to take into account.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's right.
So, yeah, you can have very complicated examples of this, but you can also have very simple examples of this just from daily life.
Yeah, which also shows the power of philosophy, because they wanted to believe in Aristotle, so they wouldn't see what their eyes were showing them. Anyways, so can we make like a very simple map of knowledge, which is something like this, right? So there is the known, and by known, I mean the stuff we measure about the world, okay? And the arrows here are to simply indicate that this known grows, right? I mean, it grows, we know more and more about the world, of course, but there is this perennial ignorance out there. And my point is that it is always going to be out there. There is always going to be a level of unknowing that is going to be part of our relationship with the world, you know? So I think of science as a mode of interaction between humans and nature, you know? And I think that mode of interaction is kind of wonderful in many ways, but we should also keep in mind
that there is this sort of out there where we may not ever be able to go. Two arms up. Go ahead. Lee had it before.
So I like where you're going, emphasizing the unknown and so forth. But I don't like the stability in the known region. I mean, so we might put something like Lorentz invariance in the known region at some point, and then we discover that it's not really true in general relativity, but it's true in some different form. And we might still yet discover experimentally that it's not actually true. Do we really believe in Lorentz rules to take the Hubble scale down into the Planck scale? So things are unstable in the center of the known to discoveries on the periphery.
I'm completely comfortable that CPT could be violated.
Yeah.
We don't know, right? I mean, people are trying to find CPT violation that would compromise Lorentz invariance in a major way, right? But we don't yet.
I would just ask for clarification of what precisely we mean by known, because a lot of things, are we talking about what is empirically observed?
Yes.
Are we talking about laws of nature in the sense of John's discussion? There are many.
I think the laws of nature are empirically observed. Are empirically observed. I think the laws of nature are things which have been measured over many years and have then been established as being a fact.
So is the known a set of facts, just events, that this instrument recorded this and here are some patterns among them? Is that precisely what you mean by the known?
Yeah, what I mean by the known is the set of everything that we have, everything we have accumulated of nature up to now. So the laws of nature, the fact that if you throw the two rocks, you know, falling down, it's not a very deep point here.
So it includes laws as well as facts that relate?
Yes, because the law is explained, as we said before, the laws, many, they're used to organize the fact. I mean, the laws organize regularities that we observe in nature. So the laws will be part, which doesn't mean, as Lee pointed out, that a law that may be true now is always going to be part of the known, because it may be proven wrongly in the future.
Because one thing to say that what we are ignorant of is facts, another thing to say that what we are ignorant of is laws.
Well, depends how you, I think the two things are not so separate as perhaps you're assuming, you know.
Well, just a funny comment on that. Mm-hmm. Yesterday I was counting up with Ariel and others. There have been, by my reckoning, no less than 7 major conceptual revolutions in the way we think about how the planets move. And all of the early ones were accurate to quite a good degree. So what we now know is actually historically 7 different accounts of how the planets move have been developed. They were all good to a certain degree, and we know that. So I think this fact of the historical evolution belongs in the known.
Absolutely.
That's all I wanted to say.
And you know, this sort of theories, you know, going over theories, you know, and that's also part of the known. You know, that's.
Well, it's just really trying to flesh out this metaphor. So the picture now is not just the known growing, but the known itself evolving, and then the growth coming from presumably new observations and new tools.
Yes.
Or sometimes feedback and
yes. And what is the known is not a, you know, it's not a time independent set in the sense that what's in there could get out. I mean, you know, but or what's known as right could become known as wrong as time goes by. That's more efficient. What was that?
The arrow is going the other direction. That might be less
misleading. Yeah, that's kind of a pessimistic way of thinking about knowledge. But maybe.
Well, I think that's a little unfair to say that the known becomes the unknown, if we pair, say, Lorentz invariance with a certain context in which we claim that Lorentz invariance is true, then I think we're pretty confident that it's going to stay known and it's going to stay true. Right? It may be that the context changes.
That's right.
We stop attributing some sort of fundamental importance to it. But I think as long as we're a little bit more careful in terms of what we claim to know, that we can limit the diffusion out into the unknown again.
Yeah, no, I'm, of course. I mean, things are... I mean, you can say Newton's laws, they work incredibly well. You know, Newton's gravity works incredibly well within its context. I mean, that's always going to be true. To say it's not part of the known because it doesn't work for black holes, it's not fair. I mean, it's You know, but so it's a fairly simple statement. I'm more interested in this, in the fact that there is a boundary here, and that this boundary moves or doesn't move, but the fact that there is this boundary, and that boundary is going to not go away.
It's also possible that stuff becomes unknown just because people forget or become disinterested.
That's or, true.
You know, things go along with them until they die or something like that.
That is true.
I think the old trade, old crafts, for example, have been forgotten. I'm not sure they're important, but things that are less relevant now than they used to be.
Yeah, until glass making, for example. So, all right. So this is, I just put that, I'm not quite sure exactly why, but just to give an idea of how, if you want to kind of organize knowledge in terms of the constants of nature, okay, at least physical knowledge, in terms of the constants of nature, it tells you a little bit about the map of what we know of the world as a function of time. Because in a sense, constants of nature, they tell you that you need them to explain phenomena that you're trying to, well, that you're measuring, right? And of course, their numbers change, right? Their numbers grow, right? Constants of nature, they have been growing a lot. And we have a few new ones now to take care of. We don't even know what the neutrino masses are, but they're massive and we don't know what they are, right? And if you actually, and this gives an example of how complicated it becomes, because if you try to implement the neutrino masses within the standard model of particle physics using the so-called Higgs mechanism, then you have to assume that there are couplings in the standard model. They are about 10 to minus 11 in size. And then you're like, what? Well, the electron has a 10 to minus 5 coupling. You know, you say, okay, it's small, but 10 to minus 11 or less, depending on what these masses are, we don't know what they are yet. So it starts becoming kind of complicated. The other one is, you know, the acceleration of the universe, right? The dark energy, is that a cosmological constant? Is that a fundamental constant of nature? What is that, right? So the point is this list going to keep going as the known increases, or does it have an end? Is there a finite number? And perhaps practitioners of superstring theories that perhaps assume that there are only four fundamental forces in nature, and that these are the coupling constants that we need to describe them, are going to say, yes, the list can end, and we are going to come up with this final theory that is going to describe all of these things in terms of one fundamental parameter, right? So that'll be, and I sort of challenge that notion because of what I said before with respect to what we do not know, right? And we cannot know that between the energies that we're probing now. So LHC just broke the record some time ago, 7,000 GeVs, right? So they can probe energies which are about 7,000 times the mass of a proton. But between that and 10 to 19 GeV, which is where Planck energies come in and all hell breaks loose in a sense, there is a huge amount of stuff, right? And so we can, and this is an interesting way how the practice goes, is that we can pick up our theories now and say, okay, we have the strong, the weak, and the electromagnetic interactions. Let's assume, nobody says that, but let's assume these are the only interactions that exist in nature, and let's then kind of extrapolate them to 10 to 15 or 10 to 16 GeVs and say, yeah, they all coincide, they become one if you assume supersymmetry and stuff. But that is making a gigantic assumption, which is there is this huge desert of unknowables there that we do not know anything about, really, that is not going to change, you know. And how the heck can we know that? We cannot know that. We don't even know if we can extrapolate our laws of energy conservation to 10 to 19 or 10 to 16 GeVs. We don't know. We use good faith and say, well, they work so well here. They work all well across the universe that maybe they also worked very early in the universe at very, very high energies. But the truth is that we really do not know, right? And we are building models to describe what we do know. So I'm just being...
It's actually worse historically. Every single time that we've gone down scales, we have always had our previous theories upended. So it's just taken the history of just to the trend analysis.
That's a good, yeah, exactly. So I wanted to switch gears a little bit and talk about another problem that to me is perhaps the hardest problem that I can think of, which is the problem of the first cause, right? And I'm sure there's some major experts on this here in the audience, so I'd like to hear what you have to say about this. But you know that when you start to think about the origin of everything, it's a very difficult problem, right? And it's a very old problem. Like creation myths from many, many different cultures across history, across time, have come up with some answer. And invariably, the answer makes a very fundamental assumption, which is there is an absolute reality out there that transcends everything that exists in the world, that has the power to create what exists. So gods, a god, some emptiness that material, that matter emerges from. There are many different versions of that, but there is this assumption. And the need for that assumption is precisely that if you start to think about causal chains between things, you are naturally led to the beginning, the first cause that is the cause that caused everything else, right? So when Aristotle was thinking about this, he came up with this wild model of 56 spheres inside each other, and they said, okay, motion has to be imparted from the outside to the inside. How am I going to do that? Something has to start the motion, but that something cannot have any motion because otherwise, you know, what would have started that? So I'm going to create an entity called the unmoved mover, which is this thing that can do it, you know, that can actually impart this motion without actually moving itself, right? So that was a solution. Kepler, right, great Pythagorean, one of my heroes, you know, he actually also thought, as a good Pythagorean, that he could come up with a fundamental theory of everything. And of course, his first cause was God. There was no question about that. But actually, he thought that it was possible to come up with a model of the universe. You have seen this before, I'm sure, which was essentially based on geometry, right? And he had the vision with the five Platonic solids. And the interesting thing here, to me, just from a historical perspective again, is that he asked a question that apparently nobody had asked before, which was, why are there only six planets at the time of Saturn, right? That's a fundamental question, right? Nobody actually, well, could there be 20, 3, 8? Why six? And because there were only six, because that's what they saw at the time, so that was the world they saw, he came up with a final theory. This is the final theory, meaning you have five Platonic solids, you put the nested spheres in there, and bang, you have a model of the world that depends on geometry. And what's really beautiful is that because of the geometry of the solids, you actually can calculate the relative distances between the shells carrying the planets, and the agreement is good to about 5%. So no wonder he flipped, because it was really quite an amazing thing. You know, it was a beautiful achievement. And he says, yes, mind can explain the arrangement of the cosmos, right? What the problem was, and you can call him his mistake, in a sense, is to have assumed that what he knew of the world then was all there was to know. And I think that's a really very dangerous thing to do, right? So a lot of final theories assume that what we know of the world now is all there is to know. And I really cannot see that. Now, going back to the problem of the first cause, now we talk about more modern questions, right? So classical general relativity leads you directly to the Big Bang singularity, right? So you have the issue that we do not know how to apply classical GR at t equals zero. There is a problem there. And so what do we do? Well, if you go and try to create quantum models of that, you come up with quantum cosmology. Now, there are two things important here. The first one is that we are assuming that we can extrapolate the laws that we have to the Planck scale. And clearly, as a theoretical physicist, I'm not against that. I do it all the time. But it's something that you have to be aware that it's being done, you know. The other one is, how is this Hawking explaining the mind of God, according to his book, works? Well, it's based on a model called the mini superspace model, which basically says this. You take all the infinite degrees of freedom that exist in geometry, and you condense it to one. Okay, and then you solve that equation for that single degree of freedom, and that you can, you know, you can write an equation that looks kind of like the Schrodinger equation for geometry, and you get a solution, and bang, you solve the problem of existence. You know, and I would say that that is confusing perhaps the model with the world a little bit. Okay, and if you go on to a deeper kind of question, which is more like the buzz now, which is the multiverse, right? So now John mentioned inflation a little bit. So
if you believe in certain models of inflation, you know, there is this scalar field over there, and you can, you don't even have to include superstrings into this. Even just with scalar fields, you can have a population of universes out there that come from the fluctuations that expand very fast from the scalar field. And so, of course, the multiverse is not a solution to the first cause problem, because the multiverse has to come from somewhere as well. And the question is, where does it come from? So the point I'm trying to make with this discussion is to say that we are stuck in a certain way in which we think about the world. And the problem of the first cause kind of strip us naked, because we really don't know how to get around this problem. I don't even know if science, and this is perhaps one of the issues here, if science, as we understand science, you're talking about, can we meaningfully talk about a physics that isn't mathematical? I don't even know how to start to think about that, you know, as a physicist. But perhaps that's the only way you can get around this problem, because truly, the way we set things up as a construction, we have to believe in certain things. And I was going to play a game, and I didn't, because we don't have time. But it would be kind of fun to do maybe at dinner tonight if you want, which is, I think we should all secretly write a list of the laws of nature, individually. Each one of us. What do you think are the laws of nature? And I bet you, yes, there will be some overlap, but I guarantee there's not going to be even close to a consensus of what these laws are. So do we go by democracy, by majority? You know, everybody's going to put the three laws of motion, maybe, or Poincaré invariance, or whatever. You know, but certainly there is going to be disagreement, because we do not know even how to define what these are. Who is going to decide, you know, what the laws of nature really are, right? And if you buy the notion that you have different levels of reality, where you have complexity that emerges because of things that are not interrelated, right? So you cannot use the Schrodinger equation to compute why a neuron works the way it works, for example, right? So what are the laws then? And how do we talk about these different sets of laws of nature, you know? So that's a problem also that, and the question that I wanted to say is that if there is a finite number of principles, and then there's this confusion between a principle and a law, right? At least to me, it's a little confusing when you think about, you know, when you talk about Einstein's relativity theory, it talks about the two principles, right? So there's the principle of relativity, and then you have the principle of the constancy of the speed of light, or the postulate, right? So what is that? Is that a law? Is that an heuristic assumption that you make in order to build a theory, and then a posteriori you show that that theory actually works because it explains so many phenomena? And does that then elevate it to a law, or does it then, what is that? You know, I'm actually not sure I know the answer. Maybe some of you would. Because, and the point is that if we cannot answer if there is a finite number of laws, then we cannot know the world in its totality. Because if we don't know if it's an infinite number of laws or a finite number of laws, we can't actually define, you know, what we know of the world anymore. I mean, we're stuck, in a sense. Okay. Taking a quick break here, I want to kind of appeal to wisdom by some of our other patriarchs, and actually still of them some movie. And I want to talk about knowledge and ultimate reality here. And what I decided to do is that before I talk about what I think, which may or may not make any sense, I made a collage of thoughts by some people we all know, okay? And I think they're kind of illuminating. So the sentence I have here on top is basically what I believe is that the world is, and the world is what we perceive and how we perceive it, you know? So, and I think there are two different things going on here. So to me, you cannot take the human from the equation ever, you know? And you can think of it linguistically, maybe we're wired in a certain way to conceive of mathematics the way we conceive of mathematics. But I want to postpone that discussion a little bit. So let me just read these for you. You know, so Carl Sagan, in his novel Contact, he says, it is hopelessly narrow-minded to imagine that all significant laws of physics had been discovered at the moment our generation began contemplating the problem. There will be a 21st century physics, we're here, a 22nd century physics, and even a fourth millennium physics. Okay? And I don't know if you ever read Contact. It's a real fun book apart from the end. Where he tried. Oh, you really believe so? About pi? Yeah. See, that shows a different fundamental difference in worldview here. Anyways, okay. Hollywood didn't buy it, though. They didn't buy it. So Frank Wilczek, he said in a summary talk of a conference somewhat similar to this, in a sense, that pure thought that didn't supersede creative engagement with phenomena as a way of understanding the world 20 years ago, he could have said it 400 years ago, hasn't in the meantime and won't anytime soon. Okay. And Weinberg, which I read this and my jaw kind of dropped, but he seems to be shifting his position considering superstrings. And he said in September 09, he says, I don't want to discourage string theories, but maybe the world is what we've always known, the standard model of particle physics and general relativity. Okay. Okay.
So that's, I guess, Weinberger's statement. But based on all you said, would we say that the string theory then is a wrong approach to physics because it's not based on what we know, it's based on some fundamental principles that are not.
No, I wouldn't say it's the wrong approach to physics. I would say it's the only, well, it's one of the ways in which we can think about physics that we don't know about, right? I mean, it's an extrapolation. It's something that is based on very sound concepts, right, of symmetries, of invariances. So we do have all of that going for us. So you can't condemn it as being a wrong approach. You can condemn it as being the wrong idea if it doesn't work. But it's a reasonable approach. Yeah,
generally. Sorry to interrupt. You touched upon it, but just to throw in here, I think that when we're thinking, it can be argued that we are doing empirical science. Mm-hmm. I mean, presumably our minds weren't just deposited here after, you know. I mean, we evolved under very specific laws and we're wired, as you touched upon, in some very prescribed way, according presumably to those laws of physics. So I think that it can be argued that it's not just we have this cavity which is separate from science, which is out here.
Yes.
We are so wired up to fool ourselves. That's the whole point. We're wired up to make quick decisions from infinite knowledge, and that means we survive as a species, but we fool ourselves all the time, and fool each other. And that's why there's science.
Right, as with energy, just like our eyes have a particular peak, right, in a certain frequency range, maybe our minds peak well over certain ranges of thoughts and not so well over others, but it doesn't mean it's a useless tool that has nothing to do with
it. It means that the verification of ideas that we have cannot come from the same source as those ideas, which are us imagining
sure,
the world.
Sure, you agree the mathematical consistency does work that way, that can be a requirement that is not related to making measurements externally, that we require that as a minimum.
I think it's much, the experience of the last 20, 30 years has shown the mathematical consistency is not strong enough to lead to new hypotheses going even one order of magnitude. It doesn't even guide us to what to expect from the LHC. Mm-hmm. If you're only going one or two orders of magnitude. Mm-hmm. So it's a very, very weak and powerless criteria.
Powerless?
Necessary but not sufficient.
Right? I would say necessary but not sufficient. Yeah. Yeah. Sort
of, but even mathematical consistency, I mean, there is no girdle. There are
Right,
mm-hmm.
I mean,
presumably
it's
difficulties
proving
that
mathematical consistency, but that is a philosophical
question. Okay. But, you know, Gödel himself didn't have said it was. Well, he went into intuitionism. But actually, going on to what Lee said, what if the consensus is, yes, we've all proven that 1 + 1 = 2, take Russell's example, and what if that's just actually a massive instance of everybody overlooking something?
Collective hallucination.
Referees overlook things, and we're all referees.
That sounds like the Matrix, you know. It sounds like the Matrix.
But that's not limited to the mind, is all I'm saying.
Oh, I agree.
That's so I just want to say the distinction between thinking and doing external viewing.
Okay.
Sorry.
No, I was just asking how much longer I have so that I we could engage. So let me just read a couple more of these because they are, I think they're very important. Heisenberg says any concepts of or words which have been formed in the past through the interplay between the world and ourselves are not really sharply defined with respect to this, their meaning. That is to say, we do not know exactly how far they will help us in finding our way in the world. We often know that they can be applied to a wide range of inner or outer experience, but we practically never know precisely the limits of their applicability. This is true even of the simplest and most general concepts like existence and space and time. Therefore, it will never be possible by pure reason to arrive at some absolute truth. And then Isaiah Berlin, whom I use in my book that I just wrote out, because he sort of speaks to what I'm trying to say in a very clear way. He talks of the Ionian fallacy, the Ionian being the pre-Socratics like Thales and his friends, in which they believed in the unity of matter. There was a oneness behind everything that exists. And so there was some absolute statement about reality. And he says, a sentence of the form, everything consists of, or everything is, or nothing is, unless it is empirical, states nothing. Since a proposition we cannot be significantly denied or doubted can offer us no information. So absolutes are really hard things to deal with. I have to hurry up because, and I won't read them all. Now, Wigner is another one that says, and I just, this is the last, Wigner is another one that says, surprisingly actually, that we just have to sometimes resign ourselves to the fact that we can't understand everything. And maybe, he says, maybe we'll lose interest in the ultimate truth, that is, in a picture which is a consistent fusion into a single unit of little pictures formed on the various aspects of nature. Einstein, what I see in nature is a magnificent structure that we can comprehend only very imperfectly, and that must fill a thinking person with a feeling of humility. And then Feynman, of course, in his unique style, every scientific law, every scientific principle, every statement of the results of an observation is some kind of summary which leaves out details because nothing can be stated precisely, you know. So all we do is we approximate reality in the best possible way that we have, right? So so the points that I want to make are written here in a sense that we are actually constructing models to describe the world. And those laws are basically a summary of empirical evidence that has been accumulated that we can trust that will carry us on until they may or may be violated, and then we have to, you know, revise those laws. But that's really how we go. And so we can even say that the measuring reality that we have is ultimate in the sense that they depend on the tools. Remember how I started this whole thing, that we use to define what reality is, right? And so basically going to this idea of the mind that you brought up, right? And yes, you know, if you think about why do we see indivisible, well, we see indivisible because we were born in front of a star that emits in the peak, you know, indivisible, right? And so we are completely conditioned by the reality in which we have evolved. And so our brains certainly are wired up to think of reality in very unique ways, which helped us survive in different conditions, that is, think quickly so that you can survive. The consequences are maybe not so important, so take away all the details and focus on what's really important, which is really what modeling is all about. So survival and modeling are not so different in a sense, right? And so the question that people always ask, but what about, and I do not know the answer to that, I would like to maybe hear what you have to say, which is, what if there is another intelligence in the universe, right? Would that intelligence, this is an old question, everybody has thought about that. What would that intelligence come up with in terms of a science? Would it be a science based on laws? Would those laws be similar to our laws unavoidable in a sense, you know? Or are there different descriptions of the world? And I would subscribe, like Michael Attia would too, I guess, to the fact that you construct realities based on what you see of reality. And so our mathematics, our science is very much our own, meaning you cannot take the human out of the picture because the way we think about nature, the way we think about the world is essentially human. So I'll stop here and
stuff like the quotation from Carl Sagan that he had, and the thing Robert pointed out about mathematics on science goes one more level down all the theories. You know, and it can make you really dizzy because you think it through the logical conclusion and you kind of realize, so everything I think has a very good chance of turning out to be wrong. And now, once I've had that thought, I can't hold all my thoughts together consistently, right? Because I think gravity is curvature, but I also think everything I think is probably going to turn out to be wrong, so there's a good chance that gravity is not curvature, but I also think so. So now there's no set of things I can think that, you know, hang together consistently, which induces vertigo. But
is that sort of an existential kind of
right
angst that you're talking about?
Yeah, but I think there's a way to get away from this angst. If you distinguish between, you know, the content of what you believe and the content of what you think and the degree of confidence you have in it. So it's one thing to say, this is my view about things, I think gravity is curvature. And another thing to say, and this is how confident I am that that's actually true, and how much I'm prepared to bet on never having to change my mind about that. And those are separate things. And for that reason, it seems to me that terms like final theory can be really unfortunate, because when you say that physics is aiming for a final theory, that sounds really arrogant. It sounds like you're ignoring what Carl Sagan said.
That's right.
And what you point out, that no matter how big the accelerators get, there's always going to be an energy level even higher, that where we don't know anything about what's going on there. So how can we ever say we have a final theory? But if we, so it seems to me the problem here is just with the term final theory. It seems that in physics there is this ambition that's, you know, perfectly legitimate, great ambition to come up with what you might call a complete theory, a theory that has laws that cover all the physical phenomena that we might ever want to describe.
Can I just make a timeout? I think that's a bit of a misconception. I think when physicists are talking about final theories or theories of everything, they're really restricting themselves to the fundamental particles and how they interact with each other.
Okay.
That's really it. It's not like you know superstrings and then you're going to explain, you know, everything else there is to explain about the world. That is really not how it goes.
Sure.
And I even know some physicists who don't want a final theory.
Sure. Okay.
Like this one.
But by complete theory, I should have said the theory that
you said physics.
You said it covers all the fundamental things.
Yeah, the fundamental particles.
But how do we know we've got all the fundamental things? Well, the things that everything else is made of. If we find something that's not made of any of these particles, then we know that that's not all the
fundamental
ones.
Right.
And you know, that's not the only ambition that can motivate science, but it seems to me that's a legitimate one, but you make it sound a lot worse when you call it search for a final theory.
I agree. It's a bad name.
Instead, you just call it, or maybe a theory of everything. Because then you're saying that you're focusing on the content of the theory you're looking for, that it's mm-hmm. going to cover a certain range of stuff.
But you
rather than saying that it's final, we're going to
right.
be sure that now physics is over.
But what's really interesting in this context, and this is one of the themes in my book, is that this is a historical thing. It came all the way back from the Pythagoreans and the Plato and the New Platonists, this notion that it is possible to conceive of such a thing. That's why I gave Kepler's example. It's a great example of this hope, if you want, right? That such thing is possible. And what I'm saying is that I don't think it's possible for all the reasons I know. So I agree with you. It is a bad name. And it gives, in fact, in the public perception of us that write books and do things like that, it gives a very wrong idea to the general public that this is really an actual goal of physics, which I think it should be.
But I guess my point is that the fact that we can't ever really be legitimately confident that we've reached the goal
mm-hmm.
is one thing. To say that the goal isn't really there.
Oh, absolutely. There are two different things. That's right. I mean, maybe there is a hidden code of nature out there, right? But that doesn't mean that we can get there. Okay.
Right, and even if we can't know for sure that we have gotten there, it doesn't follow that we can't get there.
Exactly. The problem is that even if you got there, you cannot know. But there are all these arms up. You are the boss, so why don't you do this?
I just want to ask you, the very last sentence you had, the very last bullet, you returned to it a bunch of times, every potential mind is bound to its own perception. I wouldn't say more than bound, I would say limited.
Uh-huh.
Every time that I've ever gone through a proof, either read it in a paper or written down myself, there's always been a non-zero, sometimes substantial probability that I overlooked something. Now, I'll just consider a simple IID process where that's true of everybody who looks at a proof.
in point of fact, if people take into account the fact that a particular proof was vetted by somebody else, then actually it turns out that Bayes' optimal behavior is to actually make your guess be the same as theirs and not actually give the proof the scrutiny that it deserves. Intuitively, you say, well, Paul vetted the proof, so I'm actually not going to go through it in full detail. Mm-hmm. Just follow along with what Paul said. Because of that, there's a non-zero probability that anything that we might think we can prove with our math or the probe or the computers that establish it, four color, or whatnot, is wrong. Given that we know, it's not even a simple matter of we don't have the right terms in our head, everything that we think we need to establish any kind of mathematical framework has a non-zero probability, even for getting things like Gödel, being fallacious. How then, and which I think ties in very, very strongly to your last bullet and several other concepts, how then could we even know that we have inferior everything? Or in this case, the whole issue of the laws of nature, our limitations. Mm-hmm. We could never even establish that our mathematics, even propositional logic, never mind critical logic, what Gödel applies, is correct, because we are the human beings trying to do the reasoning.
I'm with you. There's this perennial discussion, right, which some people say is really, it shouldn't be there, which is this notion of mathematics invented or discovered, right? And some people say this dichotomy is completely false. But in this discussion, you know, what is it? Is it invented or is it discovered? And I would say, well, it's false because it depends on how we think of things. So if you want to ascribe mathematics some sort of universal, and this, I'm talking about pure math now, right? So that's not physics anymore. And I'm going to kind of embarrass myself because I don't know if I can substantiate this at all, but I would say that even pure math is not a discovery. You know, it's not out there for us to discover. It's really an invention that is very much dependent on the way we are wired up, you know?
And we aren't even sure that our invention, what you think that we've established, all this wheel is round and sort of thing moving forward. But we can never know that with 100% certainty.
So, you know, I think it was Michael Attia that had this argument that if you are a being that is stuck very deep down in the ocean and cannot move but is alive, right, and there is complete darkness, and the only way you eat is because, you know, whale carcasses and whatever fall on you, right, will you develop numbers and counting and things like that or not? And you may say, well, if you have the notion of time, then you can start thinking about counting, but how does that go, right? And so,
slowly.
So.
Yeah, I want to make a meta comment because there's a part where I'm with you and a part where I'm, I think, given especially your last item, I'm strongly not with you. So there is, the part where I'm with you is the freeing ourselves from the historical legacy that science is akin to religion and it is the search for some transcendental discovery about something which is beyond time, beyond us, beyond empirical confirmation. Okay? And in this move, I think you're correct, and I think, you know, all these cautionary tales about we might be wrong about things are worthwhile because we are among the last in the intellectual landscape to free ourselves from the heritage of that kind of religion. As my sense is we're going through sort of 40 or 50 years after what, you know, what artists and writers and architects have gone through, which was the move into postmodernism. But they've already moved out of postmodernism into what's called neo modernism or post-postmodernism.
Where you
say, and this is where I'm not with you, where you say, okay, it's not true that any criteria, okay, it's not true that everybody's perception is okay. What is remarkable is that in spite of the absence of transcendence, the absence of final discovery, the absence of final theory, science is remarkably powerful and has been so and continues to be so. It is remarkable progress. There's remarkable growth in your chart from confusion and disagreement and controversy to consensus, mm-hmm. in the center. And we can't talk about reliance. We can't rely on, if we're good, honest scientists and we are honest with our colleagues, we can rely on a sense of growth of knowledge as long as we don't mess up by going back to the transcendental fantasy. And my sense is that once we do that, there are really two kinds of issues, and I want to separate. One of them is the, how does science work if it's not transcendence? There's this sort of theory of what science is and how it works. And a lot of what your talk seems to be about is cautionary tales about that. But then there's still what is nature and what we can know of nature.
Mm-hmm.
And even if we cannot transcend to the final timeless realization, even if there's not an equation, which is the final equation, there are so many interesting questions, like the origin questions that you raised.
Yeah.
How can we know, just to sort of, and I know these are concerns of yours, and you briefly touched on them, and I wanted you to spend more time on them. Okay, these origin questions are special, the origin of language, the origin of life, the origin of the universe, etc. Okay.
Right.
Are there different new methods? Science confronts these in a different way than more... unavoidable way in our period and in any previous period. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Are there new methodologies that we need to develop? Are there new kinds of questions? Are there new notions of law or explanation which are suitable for these kinds of questions?
Right. So actually, I would say we don't disagree at all. You know, Lucretius, when he was writing his poem about the Athenists, he said something like, to get rid of superstition is actually liberating. And in a sense, that's what I'm trying to do. You know, if you take this kind of idea of finality in science, you're actually free to do all sorts of other things. So I'm with you that science is a wonderful thing, and I celebrate it profusely in my book, you know, saying how wonderful it is, the picture of the world we have built. So I'm completely with you there. But I think we also have to have the humility to accept there are some questions which we do not know how to deal with. And these origins questions are difficult, you know. They're conceptually very complicated. And Paul is going to tell us why.
So in general, it's not just origins, but is there a theoretical biology, which might include the origin of life, but even a description of life? Is there such a thing? Is it meaningful to talk about that?
Yeah.
Are you raising the issue of reductionism with that question?
Perhaps. That would be included there. Yeah. You know, is it meaningful to write down anything other than Darwinian evolution as a unifying principle in biology?
Mm.
Do we ever have a theory of the cell with any predictive value? It's all just that.
So, you know, and the way we build theories are very much pragmatic. I mean, if you think about the things that actually work out, the things that we measure in the lab and do, and so when we talk about the origin of the universe, you may talk about like Gell-Mann's, you know, and Hartle's ideas of the many histories, and you have conditional probabilities to describe such things, which is one way of approaching the fact that we only have a sample, and it's the same with life, we only have one sample, and it's the same with mind, we only have one sample, and because of that, it becomes very difficult to do the kind of science we are comfortable doing, and we push things in ways that may not be always the right way to go, you know. So it's really an issue of how we do science and how the science that we do is perhaps not very well adapted to deal with these kinds of questions, you know, and do we need a new different, well, do we need a different way of thinking about these questions that is different from this this empirically validated sort of science? And this is an open question that I don't know the answer to, but by Saturday afternoon we will.
Yeah. Otherwise, we won't get reimbursed.
I think that this realizing we don't know everything is very important, certainly. And so that's a motivation to do
more, of course,
to develop a new theory. But on the other hand, the key issue is that. Knowing we don't have a perfect theory, don't have perfect knowledge, but do we know which direction can we expand our theory and knowledge? There's what I kind of say is that just know we don't know everything is one thing, but whether this knowledge can make this knowledge more useful in a sense to say which direction one theory need to be developed. And we know we have a lot of fundamental theory at the moment. And I think every physicist think they are not perfect. They just a low energy theory, some effective theory. But the efforts really try to see in which direction those theories should be more, should be developed, become more complete. And so I wonder whether there are some guidance or some hint from this more general discussion. So which direction should we seek for the new or more complete theory?
So
and
that
will make this more useful.
So that speaks to the sociology of science a little bit. It has to do with what people believe is the right way to go or where they want to go, right? So, and that implies some sort of a static judgment of what is the right thing, you know? And so if you talk to physicists that believe in supersymmetry, we're talking now about fundamental particle physics, then there is no doubt in their minds and there is absolute faith in their minds that the LHC is going to find supersymmetry and that is going to be the way in which everything is going to go. But my point is we take a step back and without data, there is just possible different directions. And so if we use an aesthetic judgment, you say, you ask people, what is a beautiful theory, right? So and you ask like, I don't know, Steven Weinberg and Wilczek and whatever, all these, you know, and they're going to give you they're going to say, oh, it's like a Mozart symphony. You know, you can't take one note off because if you do, the whole thing is less beautiful. I mean, it's absolutely perfectly constructed. Now, what is that in terms of perfection, right? That's a very subjective judgment. I would say that it's much more beautiful, just to be completely iconoclastic, I would say that it's much more beautiful to realize that there are fundamental symmetries which are violated in nature, and that those symmetries which are violated in nature are actually very much responsible for us being here, for example, parity violation and charge, you know, the CP violation that gives more matter than antimatter in the universe, the fact that there is more left amino acids than right amino acids in life systems. So to me, those asymmetries are much more revealing, in a sense, than the symmetries themselves. But that's, again, my own. So I think you touch on the issue, which is, where do we go? It depends on what you believe in.
I just wanted to come in there.
I'm sorry.
It was related to that. I just wanted to say on this question of the symmetry, in my talk I'll give an example of a theory which is perfectly symmetric, but it is bound to create asymmetrical solutions. It cannot produce symmetrical ones.
Huh.
So you'll see it on.
That's wonderful.
And it's as good as a Mondrian painting, I believe.
Yes, yes, that is very good.
Just a theme that seemed to be there in some of those books, perhaps a wonderful, but it's a very old theme, that is it's basically a worry about the capacities of mathematical processes to track physical processes for protracted periods of time. In other words, you have mathematical processes that will push forward a grid of numbers, then you have physical quantities evolving in time. And there is, has always been, I mean, Descartes and Leibniz, people that are thought to be rationalists, did believe that the universe could not be fully described mathematically because of the limitations within mathematics. And so the sort of picture that you might have is sort of like in the orthodox theory of fracture, where you have a material, okay, and it evolves, but the equations themselves just tell you that stress builds up. Then you have sort of an outside criteria. If the stress is too large, it's going to crack. Okay, so there's some period of time where your evolving equations produce this system that at some point gets out of track with reality, you know, and you can sort of probabilistically say when that would be, that's how it works, but you fail to track that process. Mm-hmm. And so it's sort of a question, is that the kind of worry that somebody like Weinberg, when he said that thing about maybe it's just a standard, maybe you can't glue together all these different tools into one unified thing that tracks a process. So it's a tracking process mathematically, and then you have some sort of correction thing that actually has to wait for some input from nature to actually start you over again.
I think it's a very good point. I think in the case of Weinberg and some other people, there is a sort of an emerging
small, emerging consensus that gravity is just a different kind of beast altogether. You know, the force of gravity is just not how the other three forces are. And perhaps to try to construct a theory that brings gravity into the scheme of the other three forces may not be the right way to go.
Well, so that would be kind of the question mathematically. You don't need to look for one animal.
That's right. So he's basically, what I see implicit in his assumption is that he's basically saying that, and he's been writing papers about how gravity is different from other forces. And so perhaps that's what's behind his notion. That's a big change of heart there, because if you look at his book, you know, Dreams of a Final Theory, he was the guy, you know, defending this reductionism to the very end, right? But he's moving in a different direction.
Nonetheless, there are physical phenomena in which the Planck scale is measurable. The combination, the Planck scale being the combination of h bar, Planck's constant, Newton's constant, the speed of light. And there must be something which explains what happens in, you know, whether Lorentz invariance is broken or not broken to order L Planck and to order L Planck squared, which is measurable in observations of the Fermi satellite or some of the OG observations in cosmic rays. It, in the very early universe, it becomes measurable. For example, are tensor modes parity even or parity odd? Is there any parity breaking in the tensor modes and inflation is a problem that the Planck scale comes into? So there are things that real experiments can measure, and therefore we certainly hope, there's no promise, but we certainly hope that there is an understanding.
I wasn't endorsing that, but I was just reporting. In fact, using functional analysis and things like that, that's a limitation on partial differential equations.
Sure.
So they actually are getting, even in this macro physics thing, there are models of very fancy mathematics that can do better on track. So I wasn't endorsing it, it's just a traditional word.
It's a funny thing that the world, you know, according to this particle vision, right, the world is made of point-like things, but we describe it in terms of continuous functions to describe what the world is like, point-like things. So it's sort of like a funny way of thinking about reality. But if you think about it, that's exactly it, right? The world, you know, if you think of particles, that's what they are, but then we have continuous functions, you know, the PDEs that you're talking about are fields, which are continuous, that you then have to quantize to describe, you know, the point-like things. It's kind of a funny way of...
A couple more questions, Sabina, and then Chris, and then looks like Rob, if we have time.
Yeah, I had a comment on something that you said earlier. So you said a lot of theories today assume that what we know about the world is all there is to know. And you later said something along the lines, you know, questioning whether there is another way to do science other than what's empirically validated. So, well, the first thing that comes to my mind is that the reason why people first try to work out theories about what's known is for practical reasons. Right? There's definitely more use than that. But as somebody who has worked a lot of time on physics beyond the standard model and quantum gravity, the thing that is very clearly validated sounds mostly cynical to me. So, I mean, there are a lot of people who make up weird things, let me put it like this, exactly about what's not known. So when I think about your graph of the known and, you know, what's not known, they might well get this. And the thing is that you don't want to go too far from what's known, so that it's hopefully empirically verifiable during your lifetime.
Yeah, and then so another way of perhaps of thinking of that is consistency enough? You know, for example, models of quantum cosmology. Just think of the solutions. A lot of it is, well, how do we know if this is right? I mean, there are different choices you can use for the boundary conditions of the universe, and how do you know? Well, they have to reproduce the universe as we know it, right? That is, they have to be consistent. They should generate some inflation, and then etc. So, is consistency enough of a validating criteria for these theories, which are so far removed from validation? You know, it's the way we work. I mean, I also did 11-dimensional supergravity, you know, and stuff like that, and quantification. And so the question is, that was a while back. I don't do it anymore. But the point is,
what is enough? You know, how do we guide ourselves in these more speculative theories? You say by not going too far out, but how do we know what too far is?
Well, I was wondering what you were trying to convey. You're saying we're not going far enough out, or...
Who, me? I have no...
Convey some message about, you know, how we could do things better.
Not really. No. I mean, I'm just basically, I'm thinking if people want to pursue their theories, they should go ahead and do it. I'm just trying to be mindful of the baggage that is going with these theories, with this way of doing physics, you know, and why is superstring so important to so many people? Well, there's a reason. There's a historical reason for that, right? And should people equate superstrings with some kind of finality? And then I'm arguing that we should not, you know, or any sort of other final theory of nature, you know. But there's no judgment from my part of what's right or what's wrong. You know, people are free to do whatever they want.
Being that's your motivation, you should re-examine what you're doing.
Yeah, I don't do it anymore, you know, but I did, and I stopped doing it because I moved to other things which I think are a little more concrete in a sense. But that's my own personal choice.
Yeah, this is maybe not going to add that much to the comments of Mark and John, but some of the Weinberg quotes and other things, I was wondering how they relate to a view that some philosophers hold that the universe could be described by a patchwork of domains that fall under different laws of physics. Now, I'm not sympathetic to that view because I think the thing Lee was mentioning just illustrated a very prosaic reason for doubting that view, which is that there all kinds of phenomena that fall within domains of applicability of two conflicting theories. And there you have just a very direct reason to look for a more complete theory. You think that both quantum field theory and general relativity have something to say about black holes. And if you want a consistent description of a system of that sort, then you have a strong motivation for trying to combine the two theories.
Or you could say you already have a consistent description. It's just a matter of applying the two theories within their scales of validity. So if you want to talk about microscopic black hole phenomena, you go EGR. If you want to talk about black hole evaporation, then you need to use quantum mechanics. And you could live very happily with that.
And
so
what happens at the end of black hole evaporation?
Well, maybe it's a puff of strings, right?
No. Then you need a theory in the overlap.
Well, right. I wasn't black hole complementarity an attempt to kind of sidestep that way of thinking? You have two different perspectives that aren't particularly, they're uncommensurable as the outside and the inside perspective. I mean, that's a kind that strikes me as a kind of way to sort of implement the sort of thing that one
I thought that was supposed to answer for the reason when you have non-local observables that far separate observables that don't.
That was black hole complementary. I don't remember, but you might be right, but I seem to remember that there was a sort of an ambiguity in the answer to whether or not evolution is unitary, but depending on your perspective. But I could be wrong about that. If it's not a relevant example, then ignore it.
So, you know, I gave a talk about my book at MIT about 2 weeks ago, and Wilczek was in the audience, and when we were talking about things, he said, you know, when we were thinking about this, that we already have a final theory. It's the standard model. That is the theory that describes everything we measure. You know, and it's a patchwork way of thinking that perhaps you're mentioning that. So it's not an impossible way of dealing. It maybe kind of wounds the historical way which physics advances, which is by trying to always have generalization, right? So the best example, of course, I think is electromagnetism. Right? I mean, you have these two, a bunch of disconnected things, and then there comes this theory that brings them together, right? Although even that theory is not a perfect unification, but that's somewhat. So I think that it's a matter of attitude, really, you know, patchwork, or do we really need to have something that goes beyond that? The point is that when you do try to unify things, you may reveal new unexpected. Like, so when Maxwell did unification, he found that, you know, electromagnetic waves travel at the speed of light, and then all sorts of wonderful things happen because of that. So it is very possible that as you approach things in a more general way, you discover new phenomena and make things richer for that. So,
one more question, and then we'll come
back. That lady.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Well,
I'm
just rephrasing what you
okay.
said. That's one more of the
words.
It's a point. It's a question. Do we have a template for something we might call a final theory, which is not based on a grand unifying principle or some overarching gigantic symmetry?
Yeah.
And that's included by exploring. If our exploring system doesn't necessarily mean we have zillions of free parameters and constants, or are there other ways of thinking about it?
And that again has to do with the idea of beauty in physics, and saying that if you have a theory like the standard model that has like 20 something free parameters, you do not say that's a beautiful theory in the sense that you want a theory that has less parameters, that you can explain all these parameters in terms of a more fundamental parameter. And that is an assumption. It's a goal in a sense, right? But it's behind the search, you know, that you want to kind of create more fundamental theories that have less and less parameters.
So maybe that's not the right way to think about it, just counting.
Well,
So you started your talk with this dichotomy between rationalism and empiricism. And as I understand it, most of the lecture was about criticizing taking too rationalist approach and championing a more empiricist approach. And I'm wondering if you'd agree that, you know, it's also important not to go too far. The pendulum could swing too far to an extreme empiricist approach. But it's important to be able to have abstraction. And I'm thinking in particular, a good example of that is Percy Bridgman's views, where he says, look, you know, we thought that there was one concept of length prior to Einstein. But really, you know, if you jump on the streetcar and you lay down your meter sticks, or if you stand by the streetcar and you measure it, you get different answers. And so we, you know, okay, we made that mistake once, but we should never make it again. We should always be careful to say exactly what the experimental procedure is that defines the concept. But, you know, taking to the extreme, that just doesn't work. You know, what's important? What I had for breakfast that morning when I measured the length? You know, you need to be able at some point to make some abstractions to make any progress at all.
Yeah.
And I'm always reminded of this nice story by Borges, Funes the Memorius, about a guy who remembers everything and all
yes.
the details, the position of every leaf. And at the end of the day, he's an idiot because he can't make any abstractions.
Right.
So would you agree that you also don't want to go too far, and that there's a
Absolutely.
Role for rationalism?
And that's where, you know, that's where I put the mind into there. I mean, the mind is a fundamental participant in this way we construct our, you know, our understanding of reality. And by that, I mean our capacity to do mathematics, our capacity to abstract and intuition, etc. Yeah. Otherwise, I'll be back to, you know, Locke and Hume and Berkeley, these guys, you know, and I'm definitely not.
Okay, I think we should wrap up, and we'll launch it up for Detroit. And 1:30, we're starting.